Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into something fascinating, the origins and, well, the current state of the internet. Our main source for this is a really insightful paper by N. Wesseling from the Hogeschool van Amsterdam. We're going to unpack how this whole thing, you know, the network you might be listening on right now even came about and where it's ended up. It's quite the evolution.
Oh, it really is. I mean, from military needs, surprisingly, right through to being absolutely central to, well, everything we do. And what's great about Wesseling's paper is how it highlights things we often just gloss over. You know, the public, the social roots of it all, and then this huge shift to platform capitalism, but also a counter movement, this thing called the public stack.
The public stack. Yeah, that sounds interesting. Definitely want to dig into that.
For sure. And we also have to touch on, you know, the really critical ethical side of AI, especially this problem of data bias. It's huge. So our mission for you listening is basically to boil down the key insights from this paper, give you a clear picture, a shortcut, really, to understanding these important points.
Okay, sounds good. Let's dive in. So, the internet's beginnings. Where are we actually starting? Late 60s, right?
Late 1960s, yeah. ARPANET. That's definitely the place to start.
Okay, ARPANET. Now, was it just about, like, researchers talking to each other, or was there something more driving it?
Well, communication was part of it, sure, but it wasn't just that. A big piece was actually economic. Computers back then were incredibly expensive. So sharing that computing power, that resource between different research institutes was a major goal.
And these research places, they often had links to the military, didn't they? Like, I remember reading about the RAND Corporation.
Spot on, yeah. RAND was a big think tank for the U.S. Army. So that whole Cold War background, it was absolutely fundamental. Security was a massive concern.
Right. So how did that need for security in the Cold War actually shape the technical design of the network?
It's actually a really key point. Paul Baran, also at RAND, he figured out pretty quickly that if you have one central hub, one central point for your network, well, that's a huge weakness. Take that out, and the whole thing collapses. So his idea, which was pre-revolutionary, was a distributed network, no single center, much tougher to attack. And the tech he developed to make that work, packet switching, breaking data down into little packets, sending them off through different routes.
Packet switching. So that basic idea of breaking stuff into little digital pieces is still how everything works online today. My emails, this call, everything.
Pretty much, yeah. It's fundamental. It was a strategic military decision back then, but the consequences for civilian life have been absolutely immense.
Oh,
unexpected, really.
Okay. So after ARPANET, what were the next big steps towards, you know, the internet that we know, towards public access?
Well, you started seeing internet service providers, ISPs, pop up, companies like AOL, CompuServe, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
They were crucial for actually getting it into people's homes, bringing it to a wider audience. And technically, there was TCP/IP. That was the protocol, the sort of common language that let all these different networks actually talk to each other and connect up.
Right, connecting everything. And then the big one, 1989, Tim Berners-Lee at CERN, the World Wide Web.
Exactly. That was a massive leap. The WWW with hyperlinks. Suddenly, information wasn't just there. It was connected. You could jump from one thing to another. Made it incredibly accessible. A huge step forward.
It's kind of hard, though, looking back at that sort of open vision to square it with, well, today, you know, the dominance of just a few huge tech companies. How did that happen? What drove that shift?
Yeah, that's the big transition, isn't it? Towards what's often called platform capitalism. These large tech companies, they saw the commercial potential, the opportunities, and they started building these huge digital ecosystems, these platforms. And their main focus, it became profit, growth, and really critically, extracting data. Shoshana Zuboff has that term for it, surveillance capitalism.
Surveillance capitalism.
Right.
Where you feel like your privacy, your autonomy online is constantly under pressure. How much control do we even have?
That's the core question, isn't it?
But Wesseling's paper, it pushes back a bit, right? It says, hang on, the internet story isn't just about corporations. There were strong community roots, too, things we tend to forget.
That's such an important point he makes. Yeah, it's easy to overlook the role of, you know, smaller research groups, the early hacker communities.
And we should clarify, when we say hacker here, we mean the original sense, right? Like creative tech people solving problems, not necessarily criminals.
Absolutely, the original sense.
Yeah.
People who loved tinkering, figuring things out. You know, there was this event, the Galactic Hacker Party in Amsterdam, also in 1989, actually. It really captures that different vibe, collaboration, sharing knowledge, exploring possibilities. It's just a different spirit, really, a community feel.
So that early spirit, it didn't just disappear. It kind of, what, went underground and is now coming back.
You could say that. Yeah, I think you see echoes of it, or maybe a resurgence, in this current push to bring back public value online. It's definitely a reaction against that big tech dominance. And that's where this idea of the public stack really comes in again. It connects back to those earlier ideals.
Okay, so tell us more. What exactly is the public stack? What does it look like?
Think of it like digital infrastructure. The pipes, the platforms, but designed to be controlled by citizens, by the community, uses open technology, shared resources. Crucially, it's not owned by one giant company looking to maximize profit. And a key principle is giving users genuine control over their own data. It's trying to create a sort of digital commons.
A digital commons. I like that. The paper mentions examples like public spaces or that Dutch project, Holland's Lucht, measuring air quality. Those are attempts to build this kind of thing.
Exactly. Those are great examples of trying to put this idea into practice.
Yeah.
Taking it from theory to, you know, actual tools and platforms that give control back.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. Now, there's another really crucial point in the source we need to cover, this whole issue of data bias, especially with AI.
Oh, absolutely vital. Yeah. The thing is, collecting data, interpreting data, it's just never neutral. It can't be. It's always shaped by, you know, culture, society, economics, history. Always. We often forget that.
And that bias creeps into everything from, I don't know, the movies Netflix suggests.
Now, all the way to really serious stuff like predictive policing. You know, algorithms trying to predict where crime will happen if they're trained on historical data that already reflects existing biases in policing. Well, you risk creating this feedback loop that just reinforces inequality. It's a major concern.
Wow. Okay. So what about generative AI then? Things like ChatGPT. Does that just repeat the biases, or can it actually make them worse?
It can definitely amplify them, because these AI models learn by finding patterns in the vast amounts of data they're trained on. And if that data is full of existing societal biases about gender, race, whatever the AI see, learns those patterns and reproduces them, sometimes even makes them stronger. You know, Caroline Criado Perez wrote that book, Invisible Women. She talks about the gender data gap.
Right, where women are just missing from a lot of the data sets used for research and design. It's not just underrepresentation, it's like absence.
Exactly. And the consequences could be incredibly serious, even life-threatening. Think about medical research. If drugs or treatments are mostly tested on men, they might not work as well, or could even be dangerous for women. And the same logic applies to other minority groups who are often left out of the data. So the ethical questions here, they're just massive. We absolutely have to grapple with them.
So reflecting on all this, it's clear the internet's story is, well, way more complicated than we might think. It's this mix of amazing technology, people working together, but also these really powerful commercial interests.
It really is. And I think understanding those public roots, those community aspects that Wesseling highlights, is actually key if we want to tackle the challenges we're facing now.
Challenges like, yeah, the sheer power of platform capitalism and this really thorny issue of bias baked into AI systems.
It really points towards needing a shift, doesn't it? A move back towards thinking about public value, about ethics, and about having ordinary citizens, you know, us, more involved in shaping how this digital world works.
So maybe a final thought then for you listening. Now that you're maybe more aware of these biases, these commercial drivers kind of built into the system, how might that change how you look at the technology you use every day? What different questions might you start asking yourself next time you log on or use an app? Something to think about.